Well, good day, and well, thank you to the Fields Institute, and thank you also to my fellow organizers for giving me the chance to give this talk. And I'll also thank in advance the experts in the audience for their patience and their forbearance with the talk. So I'm going to be explaining results, none of which have anything to do with me, but have a lot to do with several people here in the audience. So this talk is not aimed at them. It's, I hope, will make some sense to the people who were here last week and to other non-experts who are interested in understanding some of what this conference is about. So the theorem that I'd like to begin with, well, there are many names. Maybe this first board will just take the names. So. Maybe Labesa's name should be here too, and then Harris Taylor, Shin, and then Chenevier and Harris, and then Barnett Lamb, G. Garrity and Taylor. Somewhere here there should also be Taylor, Yoshida, and then Cariani. Okay, so those are just the names. And the theorem says that if F is a CM field and pi is a cuspidal automorphic representation of GLN of the Abels of F, so an irreducible representation appearing in the space of cusp forms, then such that the dual of pi is isomorphic to the conjugate of pi. So here, this is complex conjugation, which I can use to I can conjugate pi by complex conjugation on AF. I assume I get pi dual, and I also want an assumption on the pi infinity, which is, so to speak, on the weight of this cuspidal automorphic representation. So pi infinity has infinitesimal character equal to the infinitesimal character of an algebraic representation. Okay, so that's another half board. So then the statement is that then for each prime L and also a choice of isomorphism of QL bar with C, there exists a continuous, semi-simple representation from the absolute Galois group of our CM field F to GLN of QL bar. Maybe we call it R sub L, such that, so R sub L restricted to the decomposition group at V is potentially semi-stable in the sense of Fontaine at all the primes that divide L. And once that's been said, we have the following statement. We take RL restricted to GFV. So it's a Galois representation, so we can doctor it slightly and convert it into a Vedelin representation, and we can take the Frobenius semi-simplification. And this is a process that makes sense even at the primes dividing L because of statement one. This matches under the local Langlands correspondence with the local factor of pi at the prime v. So that's the theorem that I want to discuss. So just again for sort of non-experts, this is a condition on the weight. It's analogous for the case of modular forms of asking that the weight be at least 2. And then this is a statement which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. And this isomorphism is just a technical assumption, so we can compare the complex eigenvalues that appear in the automorphic representation with the erratic numbers that appear in the Galois representation, and it's that choice is implicit in this comparison of an erratic object with a complex object. So what does the matching under local Langlands mean? I just want to discuss, or to say a word about the case when pi v is unramified. So when the prime v doesn't divide the level of the cusp form pi, then what the matching means is then this Vedelin business just boils down to an element, the Frobenius element, which is an element in GLN QL bar, and Frobenius semi-simple means that we take this element and we take its Jordan decomposition, we take the semi-simple part, and this should then match with pi v, which is now an unramified representation by a setake. And then in general, of course, these could be ramified. These could be ramified, and local Langlands is a more complex recipe that describes how the ramifications should be related. So, so as Laurent said, this theorem has already, and its antecedents have already had many applications in arithmetic. But what's the a general optic in which one can view this theorem? So if you compare with abelian class field theory, which is a context where we in some sense understand a lot and have various perspectives, this result is a version of the existence theorem. So this is sort of the existence theorem, or N existence theorem, in non-abelian class field theory. And so, well, so what is non-abelian class field theory? So to a large extent, non-abelian class field theory has sort of been laid out by Langlands, at least as to how it should go. And so that sort of is the driving philosophy that's powering the ideas that prove this theorem and the ways of thinking about it. And one of Langlands' tenets is that one should not consider just the group GLN, but one should consider all reductive groups in relation to each other. And so, more generally, if G is any, say, connected reductive group over a number over any number field F, given pi, an automorphic representation of the ideals of G, we roughly expect there to be a phi taking the Galois group of F, maybe phi sub L, but I'm not going to write the L down, into the QL bar points of the L group of G. So the L group of G is, as most people here know, is built up. If we have our reductive group G, we can form the dual root datum. It has a root datum which we can dualize to form the dual group we can take the kilo bar points, if you like, take any algebraically close points in any algebraically close field of characteristic zero, and there's a natural action of the Galois group of F on the dual group that comes from the possibly non-split nature of this group G, and we can form this semi-direct product. And then this phi is a choice, is a particular splitting of the semi-direct product. Now, of course, not all pi's have a kind of an integral weight. These pi's include mass forms and so on. And so in Langlands optic, the Galois group is replaced by a more general group, the Langlands group, just as in a class field theory, the abelianized Galois group is replaced with the Vey group to handle non-algebraic Hecker characters. But we're going to only be interested in this talk in Galois representations, and so it's going to be at least psychologically easier for me to just talk about kind of Galois representations. The key dictionary here should be that an unramified pi v should match. So if this pi is unramified at v, then we would typically expect this phi to be unramified at v, and so we just have the Frobenius element at v, and again the Satake isomorphism lets us match, well, at least let us go this way. So, so here we had a theorem. Here we have an expectation. This is an expectation, and proving this theorem has been in large part about realizing various instances of this expectation. So one thing that's important to know is that we sort of have expectations in the other direction as well. So just as we have the existence theorem in class field theory, we have the Artin reciprocity law, which tells us that abelian extensions arise as class fields. And so given phis that more or less satisfy the conclusions of the theorem, we expect pi's. And then a key feature is that since we can move phis around by having maps between L groups, we can move pi's around between different groups. So that's Langlands functoriality, and that plays, again, a key role in the proof of the theorem. So, so functoriality says that if we have, say, a map between L groups, then psi mapping psi mapping the Galois group to LH gives a phi given by composing with eta mapping GF to LG. And so if we have some monomorphic form on H giving rise to this psi, we expect there then to be an automorphic form for G mapping to this phi. And so this dotted arrow is the arrow of Langlands functoriality. And, well, so there, so this was, Langlands' original formulation of non-abelian class field theory was essentially the formulation of the conjecture that this arrow exists. And there are many difficulties in realizing that this arrow exists. Well, so the most serious of which is that seems to be very difficult to try and connect automorphic forms on the two groups, but at a kind of more technical level, which plays a role in the proof of the theorem, what one has to worry about is that this map from pi to psi, or from pi to phi, is not injective. And so, if you're looking at Galois representations, and you're trying to reinterpret them in terms of automorphic forms, there can be more than one automorphic form corresponding to a Galois representation. And so this arrow is sort of problematic. Even if in some sense you imagine that you could make it, you have to take into even if you give yourself that arrow as a tool in arguments, you have to kind of give yourself the correct tool that, you know, matches with reality. And the reality is that different pi's can give rise to the same psi. In principle, different pi's can give rise to the same phi. And so this matching is not going to be literally a well-defined function from pi h to pi. It's going to be some kind of correspondence where perhaps several pi h's will correspond perhaps to several pi's. So the reason I'm bringing up these issues is because I want to try and explain them in more detail in some cases that are related to the proof of the theorem. I don't have time to discuss kind of the background on L groups and functional reality, but you have to bear them in mind, otherwise the kind of arguments for the theorem and the approach don't make so much sense. So the one issue, which is an important one, is that pi h to psi and pi to phi may not be 1-1, and therefore this dotted arrow is multi-valued in general. Okay. So now, just again to kind of return to the analogy with class field theory. So in class field theory, we have various arguments and various constructions. So, for example, we have Kummer theory, which can produce a lot of abelian extensions. And so there are arguments of a Kummer theoretic nature in the general non-abelian class field theory. For example, there are families of Calabi-Yau's that provide examples of Galois representations in the Athel cohomology. But at the moment, it doesn't seem to be possible, just beginning with those kind of constructions, to prove everything one needs about non-abelian class field theory. And so, in some sense, there's no Art and Tate book for non-abelian class field theory. And so there are other approaches to abelian class field theory that go back to Kronecker. Explicit class, or even to Kummer. So explicit class field theory of cyclotomic extensions, and then explicit class field theory of quadratic imaginary fields by CM, which turn out to be much more kind of, as a reference point, much more important for understanding the arguments for this non-abelian class field theory theorem. So the proof of the theorem is via explicit class field theory. And to a large extent, beginning with Kronecker and continuing to now, what explicit class field theory means is Shimura varieties. So Shimura varieties are the engine that drives this proof. So what are Shimura varieties? So what is a Shimura variety? So one thing we see already is that once we talk about Shimura varieties, we kind of leave just the world of GLN and we enter the more general world of reductive groups. Because the data for Shimura variety, we have to begin with G, a connected reductive group over Q. And we have to begin with a set X attached to it, which is a symmetric space. So literally, it's a set of maps from C star, often called S, the Serre group, thought of as a real algebraic group, to the R points of G. So if you have any such map from C star into the R points of G, you can certainly conjugate it by GR, and this X is a certain GR orbit. And what are the properties that it satisfies? So we should have two properties. So, well, before we describe the properties, what does such an H do? By Tanakhian formalism, this H gives a map from, if you look at the category of G representations over Q, if we take such a representation, we realify it, it gets an action of S, and that converts it into a Hodge structure. So choosing such an H, gives us a functor from G representations over Q to Q Hodge structures. And then the axioms are that GR, the Lie algebra of GR, has Hodge numbers just minus 1, 1, 0, 0, and 1, minus 1. And the second axiom should be that when I look at this H and I evaluate it on the element I and C star, this should be a Cartan involution for the real points of the adjoint group of G, so G modulo its center. But what these taken together really say is that, see, we have a family of H's. And so if we choose a particular G representation, we fix that, but we let the H change, and this Hodge structure changes. And so we get a family of Hodge structures varying over X. And then the first condition says that you have Griffith's surfaciality, and the second condition says that these Hodge structures are polarizable. So together, we say that if we send V to the collection of Hodge structures on V indexed by X, it says that is a functor from G X over Q to polarizable variations of Hodge structure over X. So it's a very natural sort of geometric set of objects. And so there are many examples. Of course. So for example, G equals GO2. So we can think of G star as GO1 of C, which sits inside GO2R by identifying C with R squared. We can take that H and then we can form its GR orbit. And then the X will be the upper and lower half plane. And if we take V, it's the standard representation of GO2. We get the family of each tau gives you an elliptic curve. Each tau generates a lattice and gives you an elliptic curve, and you have the family of H1s as a family of Hodge structures, and you get the variation of Hodge structures of the E taus over the upper and lower half plane. If G is G is P2G, you get Ziegel upper and lower half spaces, and you get families of kind of abelian Hodge structures attached to abelian varieties. And what's going to be most important to us will be when G is a unity group, where we take so how do we embed C star into this unity group? We think we have a Hermitian form with signature PQ on C to the P plus C to the Q, and we send C star, an element Z in C star, goes to the scalar Z on C to the P, and goes to the scalar Z bar on C to the Q, and that gives us our H. And again, the symmetric space will parameterize families of Hodge structures, variations of Hodge structures coming from certain families of abelian varieties. So So again, there's a reason that I want to recall this. There's a reason I want to recall the H and the kind of foundations of Shemur varieties. Because H gives us something. So we have this H is taking C star into GR, but this is a map of real groups, so we can complexify. If you complexify, this C star becomes a C star cross C star. You get a map of algebraic groups over C, and inside here we have the first C star. So this is traditionally called mu, and it's a co-character of G. So now we have this X, so this H is only up to conjugacy, so this mu is up to conjugacy. So this is a co-character of G up to conjugacy. And so co-characters are rigid. The Galois action on the character lattice is through a finite quotient of the Galois group, and so this mu is defined over some number field E. And so what can we do with it? Well, if we go to the dual side, we get a character of a torus in G, which is maybe a more recognizable object. Because if we have a character up to conjugacy of a torus of a group, we can make a representation. So we can make, going to the dual side, we convert this co-character into a character, we get a representation, a highest weight representation. And because this mu is defined over E, it will extend, well, perhaps not to the full L group, where we would put a GQ here, but at least to the L group over E. And so our kind of sort of purely Hodge theoretic looking concept of Shmuel variety somehow leads us to the objects that appear in the theory of Galois representations. And now we can pursue that lead. So we can define the Shmuel varieties, say the C points of the Shmuel variety. We have to choose K compact open inside the finite valued points of G, and then we form X at the Archimedean place, the finite Hodels mod K, maybe KF. And then, quickened by GQ. So this is a priori, we have when you sort everything out, this becomes X cross a finite set mod a discrete group. So it's a priori a complex manifold, which is a union of arithmetic quotients of the symmetric space. But it then gets promoted. So it's a complex manifold, which by Bailey-Borel, using automorphic forms, gets promoted to a complex variety. So you can, automorphic forms let you embed, there are a lot of automorphic forms, so it has ample line bundles and you can make it a complex variety. And then by Shimura, and then the work of many others who followed Shimura, it gets promoted to a variety over this field E. So this is a theory of canonical models. And once we have this variety over E, we can look at its cohomology. So we can form, so I'll just write H dot, my Shmuel variety will be fixed, so I'll write H dot etal. With the definition, we look at the etal cohomology of this variety. We base change over the algebraic closure of E, we take QL bar coefficients, and then we take a limit over K. And so this is the cohomology of this family of Shmuel varieties. and it has a lot of symmetries acting on it. It's apel cohomology over E bar, so it has an action of the Galois group of E, the absolute Galois group of E. But we've also, see, we take the limit over all these Kfs, so Kf is shrinking down to 1, so you can kind of imagine it was missing now, it's gone away in the limit, and we have a GAF action, and so there's also an action of GAF. And so now, we have kind of two groups acting here, one of a kind of, so to speak, arithmetic nature and one of automorphic nature. And they're yoked in a way we don't yet understand in the action on this space, and it's natural to kind of try and understand exactly how they're coupled. And so we have the following basic question. So here's the question. So if pi infinity, for example, is an irreducible representation of G of AF, we can look at its multiplicity space inside the apel cohomology. So we can look at all the copies of pi infinity, or we can look at the multiplicity space of pi infinity inside here. So this is the multiplicity space of pi infinity in H etal, and it has an action now. We've killed off the pi infinity symmetries. This should say pi f isn't representing GAF. We've killed off the GAF symmetries, and we're left with the Galois symmetries. And so we would like, the problem is to describe this. And this question is the basic question in the explicit class field theory of Shamur varieties. So it evolved, as far as I can tell, over time, driven partly by the theory of modular curves and then attempts to generalize it, but also kind of related to that by the general idea that if you believe in general that Galois representations should be in reciprocity with automorphic forms, then here we have some Galois representations, which then should be in reciprocity with automorphic forms. But in this particular case, automorphic forms are already there in the variety from the beginning somehow. So it seems like this is a good test case to try and explore the relation between Galois representations and automorphic forms, because you have a clue as to where the automorphic forms could be appearing. And so so at least when Langlands first wrote about this question, that was the point of view he adopted, that this was a good case to kind of begin investigating the relation between motives and automorphic forms. So, so for example, if we were to look at H naught, then this will be the smooth functions on the inverse limit over Kf of pi naught of the Shamur variety with coefficients in QL bar, where here the Galois action is just on the pi naught. And so it's just a kind of induced representation coming from the Galois action on the set of connected components. And this is described by Shimura's reciprocity law. In some sense, this arrow is dictated by Shimura's description of this Galois representation on this set. And the description is via Abelian class field theory. So it's a direct generalization of Kronecker's original ideas about the Jugendtraum. And so the problem of understanding in general the Galois action on this higher degree cohomology is again a kind of problem of explicit non-Abelian class field theory for these particular varieties. So So now I want to follow in at least some imagined version of Langland's footsteps in what seems to be the way that he kind of guessed what the answer should be to this question. So in particular, there are the letters to Lang available on the Institute website where he describes his guess to the answer here. The letters to Lang and then the article in Corvallis, which led him to endoscopy. And so I hope to begin with the letters to Lang, see how it leads to the ideas of endoscopy, and then finish the talk by explaining, in some sense, the role of endoscopy in the proof of the theorem I stated at the beginning. So the first computation Langlands made to try and understand what this Galois representation should be is to try and compute its dimension. So what is the dimension of this cohomology? And since we're on a variety which may not be compact, but for simplicity, certainly technically simpler to assume that the Shamur varieties are compact, which is to say that G ad is anisotropic over Q. Let's assume that. So these are compact varieties. And then the kind of most interesting dimension of cohomology is the middle. So let's look at the middle dimensional cohomology. So we're going to try and make this computation following Langlands. So what we do is we describe the cohomology in a different way. We compute instead the Durham, we compute it from a Durham point of view. So we'll compute the Durham cohomology. And you can compute this just by the Durham complex. Our Shamur variety is described as a kind of quotients of homogeneous spaces, so it's very easy to relate it to the group theory, and you get an answer, which is, you get so G is the Lie algebra of G, the complex Lie algebra, and K, so here G is the complex Lie algebra of G, and K is the complexification. Just choose some H. Choose a base point in X, and it has a stabilizer, which is a Levy, and also a Levy, and you can take its complexification, that's K. So the GK cohomology of L2 functions on the GA mod GQ. So essentially in the formula for the Shamur varieties, remember the Shamur variety is X cross GA mod K mod GQ. But once you take the limit over K, this mod K goes away. So we can sort of think about this object. And this X is GR mod KR. We sort of take the Durham complex here, we pull it back, and then we describe it in terms of the Lie theory of G and K. So this GK cohomology is some Lie theoretic cohomology of this G representation. And now this G representation, essentially by Hodge theory, by a version of Hodge theory, well, what is it? It's a Hilbert space direct sum of pi's, each with some multiplicity, where these pi's are some irreducible representations of GA. And each pi is an irreducible representation of this group, which is essentially a product group, and so it has its component at infinity, which is a representation of the real points of G, and has its components at the finite places, which are a representation of the finite hadelic points. So here we have GR, and here we have GAF. And so the point is that this GK action, this is coming from the Archimedean place, it only acts on this pi infinity. And so in this cohomology, we can separate out these two factors. So this is the sum over pi f of the sum over pi infinity of the Lie algebra cohomology of K with pi infinity coefficients tensored with pi f, and then we have a multiplicity which is the multiplicity with which pi tensor pi f appears in the automorphic spectrum. So this multiplicity. And so we see that if we take now, so if we call this thing h to rm, this limit, if we take h to rm and we compute the pi infinity part, well, the pi f part, we just have to look at the contributions for fixed pi f, and so we get the sum over pi infinities of the cohomology. So this has nothing about pi f, but where the pi f contributes is just here. There's a multiplicity, which is the multiplicity of pi infinity tensor pi f. So if this pi infinity was all, like if this pi f was trying to be a modular form of weight 3, and this pi infinity was trying to kind of be a modular form of weight 4, then this multiplicity would just be 0, because you couldn't find this. There would be an abstract representation of the idyllic group that was a tensor product, but it wouldn't be automorphic. So somehow, for this multiplicity to be positive, this pi infinity and pi f have to somehow speak to each other in some reasonable way. But now we return to the problem of the non-injectivity of the maps from pi's to phi's. These two have to speak each to each other in a certain way, but they're not speaking in complete concert. At least this pi f doesn't lock down a single pi infinity. So, but okay, that's the formula for the dimension. And now we wanted to compute the middle. So what pi infinities contribute GK cohomology in the middle? So pi infinity computes GK cohomology in middle degree. For example, the most important pi infinities that do that is the discrete series ones. So if it's a discrete series, in other words, if it's a constituent of the L2 functions, not just on G, A, mod GQ, but if this pi infinity is a constituent in the L2 functions on the group itself, so it's a discrete series, then it contributes in the middle. And then we have the kind of following formula, which was observed by Langlands, which is that the dimension of the sum over pi infinity discrete series of the middle dimensional cohomology is equal to the dimension of V mu. So that's the fundamental formula that drives all the investigations in the theory of the cohomology of Shimov varieties. Because what's happening is, so let's be optimistic. Let's imagine that things are like in the modular curve case. Let's imagine these multiplicities as, let's say, 0 or 1. So we can kind of forget they're either there or they're not. They're 0 or 1. Then what will this sum be? Well, imagine we had a pi f which could match with every pi infinity that was discrete series. So imagine we had a pi f that could attach itself to any discrete series pi infinity and the multiplicity was 1. Then this would be the dimension of the pi f part of cohomology, and its dimension will be v mu. Now we're trying to understand the Galois representation on this vector space, and so far we just have the vector space as a vector space, we have its dimension. But now we can imagine what the Galois representation will be, because by our general non-abelian class field theoretic philosophy, this pi, so pi infinity tensor pi f is supposed to give rise to a phi taking GQ to GQ semi-direct product G hat, and so if you restrict to GE semi-direct product G hat, and that acts on V mu. So V mu, if we believe all of non-abelian class field theory, V mu comes with an action of the Galois group of E, which is not coming from the Shimov variety, it's just coming from the general principles of non-abelian class field theory. But here we've built an actual physical Galois representation in the cohomology of the same dimension. So it seems natural to imagine that those are the same representation. And so that was Langlands' kind of first guess, is that the Galois action on the middle cohomology of pi f is equal to the GE action on V mu by a phi. So recall, for example, in the case of GO2, this V mu is a standard two-dimensional representation, and so those are the Shimov varieties of the modular curves. So this is the H1, and those are the two-dimensional Galois representations on the H1 of modular curves attached to modular forms. If G is GSP4, then the V mu is again a four-dimensional representation of the dual group, which is again GSP4, and you expect to see four-dimensional representations in the middle, so the H3 of Ziegle threefolds. If G is GUPQ, so I didn't say what V mu was, but let me correct that now. V mu is the p-th wedge power of the standard representation of GLN, maybe up to a twist. So the G hat for this GU is basically GLN. It's a GM, GL1 cross a GLN. So it has the standard n-dimensional representation, and then you take the p-th wedge power. Which, notice, if I took the q-th wedge power, since the top wedge power is, again, the determinant, this up to twist means I haven't really had to think about whether I should write p or q. The L group is acting on independent of pi, but the phi depends on the pi. So okay, but so this is what Langlands explains in the letter to Lang. Historically quite interesting, because this is just a few months before Deligne's the key seminar on Shimov varieties. And so the H and mu haven't yet been introduced, but Langlands writes down a mu root system by root system. For each root system that gives a Shimov variety, he kind of writes down the mu to verify this guess, to verify that this guess makes sense. And so, but the problem is that for this guess to be valid, we would need that this thing is automorphic for every pi infinity, a discrete series, if it is for one of them. Otherwise, if that's not true, then if not all the pi infinities contribute, then this thing will have smaller dimension than the dimension of V mu. So that's the beginning of the story of endoscopy. So contributing. I always had kind of constant coefficients. So contributing to the middle cohomology, so in other words, if one of these summons is non-zero, you need them. If one of these numbers is non-zero, you need them all to be non-zero. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Yes, I already said that. I'm going to simplicity imagine the multiplicity is one if it's not zero. So the way that Langlands kind of reasoned about the situation was the following, that if this turns out to be a smaller dimension, maybe it's because there's only a piece of this appearing. Well, how would it happen that there's only a piece of this representation appearing? After all, this V mu was built as an irreducible highest representation of G hat. So how could there only be a piece appearing? Well, the thing is that the Galois representation is not a representation of G hat, it's a representation of GE under this phi. So phi is making GE some subgroup of G hat, and we just know we have an irreducible representation of a group that could become reducible when you restrict to a subgroup. And so that's what Langlands imagined would happen, that perhaps the cases where there's kind of where you don't get equality of dimensions here could be because of this reducibility phenomena. So where does reducibility come from? Well, we want to make, sort of part of the philosophy is we want to make arguments that are kind of somehow living in this G hat, in the L group world, and not referring to the particular Vs. To kind of have some sense that our arguments are intrinsic and meaningful. And so, one way the reducibilities will happen is, if your subgroup has a non-trivial centralizer, then the representation of, if the image of phi here has a non-trivial centralizer, then this phi mu is a representation not just of GE, but of GE product that centralizer. And now that centralizer could break V mu up into pieces. And that's somehow basically the mechanism by which you can imagine the kind of basically the only abstract group theoretic mechanism you could really imagine, which will produce kind of systematic decomposition of a representation of a group. So the problem is, how could V mu decompose, or why would V mu decompose under the action of phi of GE? So that's sort of the question. And the answer is, if the centralizer in G hat of phi of GE is non-trivial. Well, so what does non-trivial mean? Well, the centralizer will certainly contain the part of the center of G hat that's fixed by GQ. And then more generally, if the centralizer contained a contribution in the dual group from some larger non-split torus, some non-central split torus in G, that will correspond to phi kind of factoring through a levy. So if phi factors through a levy of the L group, then this V mu is reducible for kind of a fairly trivial reason, that phi is really coming from an Eisenstein series and it's coming from lower rank groups. So there's sort of one case, so the most interesting case, is when this when the connected component of C phi is contained in ZG hat. But C phi itself is not. So this is a case that gives reducibility without factoring through a levy subgroup. And so it's a case when the phi, the Galois representation into the L group might be reducible, but not because the pi is an Eisenstein series. And this is called the elliptic case. And you won't see it for GLN, because if the G was GLN and the G hat was GLN, then you have an n-dimensional representation, and that kind of breaks up into irreducible sub-representations, and you compute by Schur's lemma, you kind of compute the endomorphisms and you get connected groups. So it's a phenomenon that only happens in groups that are not GLN. But for example, it can happen for unity groups. So for unity groups, we can put, if we have, say, n as odd, and we write n as n1 plus n2, I can look at a kind of similitude group for un1 plus un2. I can take its L group, and you can embed that into the L group of G-U-N. And we could imagine we had a Galois representation. Well, so we had so this is an example of what we had before. Here's eta, here's a psi, here's a phi coming by composition with eta. And let's imagine that the image is Zariski dense. Then if we compute C phi or C phi naught, it has order 2. So it's a group of order 2. So that will be an example where when we look, if we happen to have an automorphic form on the unity group whose associated Galois representation happened to be factoring through here and be Zariski dense, then when we looked at the action when we looked at a Galois action on V mu, there wouldn't just be an action of the Galois group, there'd be a commuting action of this group of order 2. And so in the last few minutes or so, let me explain what happens. So the representation pi f, if I return to my situation of pi f for my Shamov variety, the representation pi f gives rise to a character of C phi of this connected group. And we have a formula, well, at least this is the conjectural formula now for the multiplicity of pi infinity tends to pi f. Well, so pi infinity also gives rise to a character of C phi. So in our example, in the unity case, this is just a group of order 2, so a character is just a sign, and this is just a sign. And then the multiplicity formula is that we have to see how these signs match. So we do the following sum. Let me here write C phi mod C phi naught. We sum over X in C phi mod C phi naught, the character attached to pi infinity on X times the character attached to pi f on X. And that's supposed to be the formula for the multiplicity. I'm sorry? Yeah, well, I was only looking at the tempered case, always. I should have said that I was only in the tempered case. So this is the formula. So if we do this sum now over all these pi infinities, we get a sum over in pi infinity of the characters of pi infinity at x and the character attached to pi f at x. And the key thing is that this character, this is v mu. So we know what this is. So in this case, this v, in our unity case, our v mu, this is the standard representation of dimension n, and it breaks up as the sign, we have our c phi is, this is a group of order 2, as acting on the standard representation of dimension n, and we get the sign character to dimension n1 plus the trivial character to the dimension n2. And so this is just the sum in representation theory. We have to see how much this character can, whether this character appears here. So this is also a character, this is either the trivial or the sign. So this sum either gives us N1 if it's a sign or N2 if it's the trivial. And so that's the way we can try and compute the actual dimensions that are realized in the cohomology. And so finally, the method of proving the proving the theorem is to judiciously choose the unity group in the Shimura variety so that you can establish this formula. So this is a kind of conjecture that I've written it, but the theorem is proved by establishing this formula in various cases. And then carefully organizing the sign here so that it lets you pluck off exactly the dimension of Galois representation that you're looking for. So, since I'm out of time, I'll have to stop there.